Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, how are you doing? This is Ben, this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Welcome aboard. Many thanks for joining me for episode 62, which features former Reuters wire photographer, the multi-talented Finbar O'Reilly. As is customary, I will do a bit of housekeeping before I introduce Finbar properly. If you'd like to join the minuscule percentage of listeners who think the podcast is worth the cost of an overpriced cup of coffee per month, please sign up for a small recurring monthly donation at bensmithphoto.com/a small voice. And to the 26 people who do that already, you rock. In all seriousness, thank you for being awesome. Subscribe and leave a review on iTunes if you would. There's about 77 on there currently. Let's try and get that number to 100, shall we? That would be fun. Apparently it makes a difference. I don't know. I might even shut up about it if we achieve that goal. So let's see if we can. Also, if you or anyone you know needs a new website, do get in touch via ben@bensmithphoto.com. I can sort that all out for you using the Squarespace platform. No problem at all. Not much point in me advertising my photography services, is there? Well, that would just be silly. You know what else I was thinking would be nice? Get in touch. Hit me up, say hello, just like email me or message me on social media or something. Let me know you're out there and that you're listening. Otherwise, I may be tempted to assume that I'm talking to myself here. I don't know. Like right now, I'm sitting on my bed because it's quieter in here. And I don't know if you're listening, do I? Do you feel me? See, that's my little bit of street vernacular I can get with the kids. So, Finbar O'Reilly. Finbar spent 12 years as a Reuters correspondent and staff photographer based in Western Central Africa and won the 2006 World Press Photo of the Year. His coverage of conflicts and social issues across Africa has earned him numerous awards from the National Press Photographers Association and Picture of the Year International for both his multimedia work and his photography, which has been exhibited internationally. Finbar was based in Senegal for 8 years, spent 2 years living in Congo and Rwanda, and his multimedia exhibition Congo on the Wire debuted at the 2008 Bayeux War Correspondents Festival before then travelling to Canada and the US. Finbar embedded regularly with coalition forces fighting in Afghanistan between 2008 and 2011, before then moving to Israel in 2014 where he covered the summer war in Gaza. He's a 2016 McDowell Colony Fellow and a writer in residence at the Carey Institute for Global Good, a 2015 Yale World Fellow and a 2014 Ockberg Fellow at Columbia University's Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma, and also a 2013 Harvard Nyman Fellow. He's a closet intellectual, really. He's among those profiled in Under Fire, Journalists in Combat, a documentary film about the psychological costs of covering war. Early this year, Finbar, along with co-author, retired US Marine Sergeant Thomas James Brennan, published a joint memoir with Penguin Random House about their experiences in Afghanistan entitled Shooting Ghosts. Their story about the unpredictability of war and its aftermath is told in alternating first-person narratives and explores the things they've seen and done, the ways they've been affected, and how they have navigated the psychological aftershocks of war and wrestled with reforming their own identities and moral centres. Finbar is currently based in London. We had a great chat. I really enjoyed it. It was very honest and very candid and quite revealing, and I really hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. Is it weird for you to suddenly be kind of settled after all those years of being, you know, peripatetic?
Yeah, it is a little bit, but on some level, I think I needed that as well to be a bit more stable and based somewhere that, well, I wouldn't say yet that London feels like home, but I'm not bouncing around in the same way that I used to for assignments and so on. Now it's seeing friends, seeing family, doing the occasional assignment. And the last 2 years, have we started, by the way?
Yeah, we started.
Oh, sorry.
No, no, it's fine. This is how we roll.
No, that's fine.
Finbar, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, having basically spent the last 2 years working on this book, I spent a lot of time at our family home in Ireland. And then also on writing residencies and fellowships in the US that were facilitating the writing of the book. So I haven't been completely based here. It's only been a couple of months now that I've been in London. Yeah,
but by your standards.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, yeah, there were times when I was based in Dakar, covering Western Central Africa and sometimes Afghanistan, where I would be, I think 1 year I counted it, that I was home at my place in Senegal for a total of 6 weeks in the course of the year. The rest of the time I was either on assignment or taking a break after an assignment. Wow. And that was perhaps my busiest year of travel. So by comparison, even though I travel, you know, quite a bit still at the moment, it feels a little bit more balanced. But I think that's a healthy thing. That's what I wanted.
No, definitely. I just presume it just gets not just physically tiring, but just kind of psychologically knackering to be on the road all the time, does it?
It does. I mean, there are two ways to, you know, the reason you do it is because you love the work and it's stimulating and it's invigorating. And there were times where there were lulls either in the work or the assignments for whatever reason, the news flow or things were bigger were happening in other parts of the world or budget constraints where, oh, we can't travel right now for whatever reason. And then you'd start to go a little bit stir crazy at home, based in Dakar, which is an interesting place, but not a lot of news is happening there. So you'd have to sort of dig up features. And I always found that a little bit harder to do at home, even though now when I go to visit Senegal, I look everywhere and say, wow, this, why didn't I ever do that story? Why didn't I ever do this story? You know, the kind of things that when you live in a place, you tend to overlook. And a visiting photographer may like roll in and see things that you don't see, which just happens all the time. You know, you tend to overlook stuff that's on your doorstep sometimes. But I can't remember what the original question was.
Nor can I, actually. Yeah. But you raise a good point about that whole thing of, you know, the familiarity of your surroundings. And as a photographer, you know, you kind of want to be inspired to shoot. But, you know, it's hard to find stuff on your own doorstep when, you know, you're so familiar with it. But then, like you say, someone who comes in from inside finds it all terribly fascinating. You know, it's a really interesting thing. I think a lot of people, seems to me there's more of a move towards shooting closer to home for a lot of people. Do you think that's true?
I don't know. I can't say that I've noticed that, but, you know, people like Jonas Bendixson, the Magnum photographer, he's done lovely work at home, even after his big projects overseas in the sort of satellite Russian states. He went home and he worked for a small Norwegian newspaper for a while, a daily newspaper.
The idea
of that is really lovely. And other photographers, you know, Brian Denton for the New York Times covers the Middle East out of Beirut, but he went back to the U.S. a while ago and did a lovely story on the U.S. I can't remember the specific focus of the individual story, but it was a look at rural parts of America. And I think when you go away and you come back, you do tend to see things fresh in your homeland. So I lived in Senegal for 8 years and I was always seeing stories, but I'm home from assignment. I kind of just need a bit of a break from seeing, from looking, from photographing. And that was home. And now when I go, I've been down the last 2 years for a visit, and it just feels like a visual feast when I see, oh, I should come back, I should do that story, I should do this, all these things that I didn't shoot when I was there.
Yeah.
Just because it was, oh, I could do that anytime, I could do that anytime, and you tend to overlook it. But even, you know, even here in London, it's easy to overlook stuff. One of the people who got me into photography originally is my uncle. He's a photographer, and he does very fun projects here in the UK, where he, you know, this thing on my coffee table here, it's a bunch of what looks like junk in a little frame, but it's actually all bits and pieces of things that he's collected from the foreshore of the Thames. And there's bits of old clay pipes, there's bits of old dolls, buttons, bits of plates and things that date back centuries, and Roman coins and all kinds of things. And he will put those together and he'll photograph them. And, you know, he has a very kind of mindful approach to looking at familiar things in a new way every day he steps outside with his camera. And that's one of the things that I kind of picked up from him over the years, is trying to see things in a fresh way, even though they may be familiar. And he certainly does that here. I'm always amazed when we go for a walk down the street. I kind of sometimes switch my visual brain off, which does make me question how much of an ingrained photographer I really am. Maybe I'm not, because I didn't start out as a photographer. I got into it quite late. but he's always kind of looking in a visual way at things, and it takes us forever to walk down the street because he'll point out this, look at this manhole cover, or look at that brickwork on there. Those are little things that we can see through the window from here. Those metal crosses, you know, I would never even really have noticed those, but he would explain to me that that's actually running through, there's a metal cable running through the building there that's holding the tension of the wall together. All these kind of little things. Some of those can be quite decorative, and you might photograph them. So there's all kinds of stuff around us that we can so easily walk past.
And you remember him being like that even from when you were young?
Oh, always. Yeah. It was always fascinating, and still is fascinating to go out for a wander with him and just see the world through his eyes for a little bit. And I think a lot of that rubbed off on me in the way that I started to look at things around me. I tend to switch it off and on when I need to. His always seems to be switched on.
Yeah. I think there's so many ways of approaching it. I mean, you do hear about photographers who, you know, always have a camera with them. Some photographers wouldn't dream of, you know, doing that necessarily. There's just a million different ways of approaching it. I think that's one of the nice things about photography, I suppose. I'm going to completely abandon the plan that I had now, which is probably a bad idea.
Let's just roll with it.
Well, let's get the sort of superhero origin story then. So your roots must be Irish, right? But you were born in Wales and then you grew up in Canada. So that was a bit of a...
And then I've lived overseas for 15 years. Yeah, I'm a bit all over the place, which I think in many ways reflects the nature of the work that I do. You know, it's multinational, it's multicultural, and I think a lot of photographers you'll find are from these diverse backgrounds and have, you know, itinerant you know, histories and so on. But yeah, my dad is Irish, my mum is Welsh, and they were living in Ireland when I was to be born, but my mum took me back to Wales because all the men on her family side played for the Welsh rugby team when they grew up, all her uncles, cousins, and so on. So the idea was that when I got older, I could play for Wales if I wanted to. As it happened, when I was 8 or 9 years old, we left Ireland because of the troubles there and the political and religious tension, and we moved to Canada. So I grew up in Vancouver there and did my high school and college in Canada. And then, you know, I did journalism. I basically traveled. After I finished university, I spent 2 years backpacking around Africa and Asia. Mm. And that was in 94. So I happened to be in Rwanda just as the genocide was beginning and the country was starting to implode. And then I went straight to South Africa where the elections were being held and Mandela was elected president for the first Black president after apartheid. So I kind of experienced the worst of what people can do to one another and the sort of the best things in humanity with the beginning of the genocide and the end of apartheid within the span of, you know, 2 months. And it was a very intense experience for me as a young person and just out of college trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I would read all the news and media reports, and some of which I thought, well, that's not right. That's not what I'm seeing, or I don't sense it to be that way. And I thought, well, I feel like I have something to say about these, or I would like to be involved in the way that these stories are told. And I want to keep traveling to these places. So journalism seems like a good thing to go into. So I went back, saved up a bit more money because I'd spent everything that I'd managed to put together beforehand, and applied to journalism school. So I did a 2-year journalism grad program in Toronto. And then got internships with the national newspapers in Canada. So I did that for a couple of years. But as an arts correspondent, I was covering, you know, it's not what I planned to do, but that's the job I got offered out of university. So I was covering pop music, stars and celebrities and interviews and doing concert reviews and going to, you know, the Grammys in LA or Woodstock and these kinds of things and film festivals and parties. And it was a great old time. But I think it was about the third time that I interviewed Lenny Kravitz, I thought, maybe this is kind of not, you know, really what I want to be doing for the rest of my life, even though it's a plum job staff. You know, it was a different climate. There was a very vibrant newspaper business at that time in Toronto, one of the most vibrant in North America. This was in 97 to 2000, a new newspaper, really competitive market, and they were hiring young journalists right out of school. So it was a great opportunity. But I knew that I wanted to do something more than that, something more meaningful than, you know, more or less being an extension of public relations for these celebrities and artists and filmmakers and so on. It was great fun as a young journalist, but there was a limited time frame to it. So I contacted Reuters, in the Reuters bureau chief in South Africa, and as it happened, they had a job coming up in Congo at that time. Their stringer, sort of freelance contributor, was about to leave after having been there for a couple of years. I went in for an interview, and they said, "Great, what, can you start next week?"
Wow, really?
So I thought, okay. Well, if I'm going to go, I may as well just jump in the deep end, and took off to cover, you know, one of the biggest conflicts, the biggest conflict, the deadliest conflict since World War II. You know, we're talking several million people have died there in the last 20 years. As I was leaving to go, 9/11 happened. And for a moment I thought, oh, hang on, this changes everything. The whole focus now for the next decade really is going to be on Asia and Middle East. Maybe I should go there if I want to make my name as a young foreign correspondent. But then I thought, well, everybody's going to go there. That's going to be the focus of attention. All the big shots are going to be there. It's going to be hard to create space for myself. Maybe I'll just stick to my plan, head to Kinshasa, which I did, because I knew there would be great stories there to be told, even if they didn't get huge amounts of space or attention. It would be a place where I could maybe contribute something of value to the stories coming out of that region. So I did, and I ended up spending pretty much the next 2 years covering the war in Congo. Mm. When I say covering the war in Congo, that might sound dramatic. It was very not that way, because it's such a huge country. It's the size of Western Europe, and it has about 200 miles of paved roads. So we're not talking like running to the front line type of thing. It was really just working phones, doing interviews, trying to do stuff, uncover stories that were often in very remote parts of the forest or other parts of the country that were completely inaccessible. So it was
almost a kind of invisible conflict in a way.
It was very hard to see what was going on a lot of the time. That changed later when some of the rebel groups threatened larger cities in different parts of the country and you could get to the front lines. But otherwise, you might hear about a massacre or a battle that had taken place 2 weeks before, and it had taken that long for people to trickle through the bush, down the riverways and water arteries to the bigger towns and report stuff to the UN or tell people what was going on. So you would hear about stuff really late. And then to get there would be, you know, a massive logistical challenge to try and verify any of these reports. So a lot of it tended to be, you know, economic reporting, because Congo has a lot of the mines and natural resources, which is what a lot of these conflicts are about: diamonds, gold, timber, all that kind of thing. So it was, you know, when I say I cover that war, it's not as dramatic necessarily as it sounds, although it did become more visible at a later date.
So it was kind of a... it eased you in a little bit. It wasn't like a baptism by fire while you were suddenly. Yeah. But when was your first experience of kind of proper conflict then?
Well, what would happen is you would often go and cover protests or elections in even local elections in a place like Congo, and you would have clashes between security forces and opposition members that can get quite violent. And as general elections approached in 2005, 2006, there were a lot of running street battles between the candidates and the presidential guard. And in a sense, I did have a bit of a baptism by fire when I moved from writing from Central Africa in Congo. I took a position with Reuters as a photographer in West Africa, based in Dakar, in 2005. And one of the first assignments I went to was to cover elections in Togo. And that turned into a very violent and kind of dangerous contested election, where there were a lot of clashes between the opposition and the government forces. Mm. And that was really, you know, my first, what felt at the time, like quite serious street fighting. And it was, in a sense, but that over the years after that, that became a pretty large part of the staple of much of the coverage that I was doing from around there.
Did you feel that this was what you were supposed to be doing in a way?
No, I'd never set out. First of all, I'd never set out to be a photographer. I was a reporter and a journalist.
Yeah, actually, I was thinking more. I wanted to sort of cover this sort of transition, really, from writing to photography, because obviously it's incredibly important. But in terms of just being a journalist generally at that time, when you were still writing and you know, going to Africa, you didn't know for sure whether you were going to take to it. But did you take to it fairly quickly?
I mean, when I'd been working in Canada, I was working for a paper that had loads of space, so you could write as long as you wanted. You could write a 2,000-word article or profile of, you know, some celebrity or whatever it was. When I got to Reuters, you have to be very disciplined and use an economy of language for 300, 400, 500-word dispatches. And that was a really good way to learn the craft of journalism, being concise and conveying a lot of information in a limited amount of time and space, and to do it very quickly when things were happening, when news was breaking. And so I took to that as a way to learn that side of the craft. I've always liked writing longer, so that grated a little bit for me sometimes, and the occasionally formulaic way that these news stories have to be written, you know, with a tight lead and then the nut graph explaining what the story is about, and then the boilerplate background paragraph about explaining, you know, the context, and then the story's over. So
it is you're really writing to a very formulaic kind of
And the people who do that really well can kind of recycle these ways of writing in a creative way, so that they don't always read the same way and you're not copy and pasting from a previous story. You have to reword the same thing often, over, you know, hundreds of times over the course of a year, from a story from Congo or from something where there's a running story that you know shifts slightly, but not massively in terms of the trajectory. But I did take to the region. I loved living in Congo. It was challenging. It was sometimes very hostile and difficult. But I was a young journalist with a sense of adventure and a taste for doing things that were different. I didn't want to, you know, when I was working in Canada, I saw the journalists in the newsroom who were a generation older than me, and none of those newspapers in Canada were going to send me overseas as a foreign correspondent. You had to work your way through the paper for 20 years, and I just didn't. I was impatient. Yeah, I wanted to just go. And when I got there and I saw the Reuters correspondents, and, you know, I was 30 at the time, and I said, I need to go overseas by the time I'm 30. So I went when I was 30. I got there, and a lot of the Reuters correspondents who'd been doing this for a couple of years were, you know, my age, or, you know, 25, 26, 27. And they'd been up through a different system within Reuters, but they, you know, they'd been doing this for a while. Mm. And it suddenly seemed like, oh, there is space for our generation in a newswire context. Mm. Because the younger, the single, are often the people who are willing to go out to these more difficult postings and do it. And so, yeah, I took to that aspect of it. It was a fascinating place. It was a difficult place, but I made very good friends there. I joined local basketball teams because I played basketball in college in Canada. And that was a great way to get to know people and enter into the local community. Of course, you have, you know, your other group of expat friends, but it's very easy when you live in a place like this to exist in an expat bubble. And there's some comfort to that, to have those cultural touchstones, to be able to speak English and that kind of thing. But it's also important to have your local friends that you can interact with, that you can get a feeling for the country and the issues at hand, and to just feel part of the place and not a complete outsider, although you always will be an outsider. Mm. But to really sit around and, you know, play basketball, have jokes, and go for beers in the local neighborhoods. Those are the parts that you love the most. Those are the parts that you remember more than, you know, the nice dinner you had at the sushi place with your, you know, fellow journalist or aid workers and that kind of thing. Mm. You don't remember that so much.
Right.
I mean, you do, but the more memorable times, the more treasured times are the evenings and the days and the weekends that you spend with your local friends, who I'm still in touch with to this day. Mm. So, yeah, I know, it took to that part of it, and that becomes your life. It's, you're not just there as a journalist, it's your whole kind of existence.
So let's kind of talk about this transition to photography. How did that happen?
Well, I've been working in Congo, and then I was based in Rwanda, also covering Congo and the Great Lakes region. And the Rwandan peacekeepers were being sent to Darfur in 2004 to, as part of an African Union peacekeeping mission in that region in Sudan. And I went with them. And at that time, Darfur has become a much better known conflict in the years since, but that was really the beginning of what was happening there in terms of the government and what has since been labeled the genocide against their own people. And we had nothing. And so our pictures team said to me, look, we don't have any pictures from there. Can you send pictures? So they gave me a decent camera and they gave me a sat phone for sending. And while I was in Rwanda, I'd been living, sharing a house with two photographers from AFP and AP, the other two main newswire services. So I would see them working and, you know, I would sometimes take some snaps here and there to go with my stories, because what was happening is their pictures were going with my stories when they ended up in newspapers. And I thought, well, I should just be taking my pictures from my stories, not using theirs. So I'd picked up bits and pieces, and I'd always had an interest in photography. And I went to Darfur and I spent a month there, and I was writing for Reuters, I was writing for The Economist, and I was taking pictures for Reuters as well. And it's a visually very powerful place. And the thing I had learned over my couple of years working in Congo and Rwanda and then in Darfur is these are big stories. I mean, we're talking about lethal conflicts, millions of people have been killed. And in Darfur, you have a genocide unfolding. But when it comes to how it's played in newspapers, it's getting a brief of a couple of inches in the news columns beside the main stories from Middle East, Gaza, Iraq, Israel, all of these stories where the death tolls were much lower, but the political interest was much higher. And when I started taking pictures from Darfur, what happened is they ended up on the front pages of newspapers, on New York Times, Herald Tribune, double page spreads in European magazines, and ended up in pictures of the year's selection around the world. And this really struck me. First of all, I enjoyed the process. The way that you engage with people with a camera is quite different than when you're talking with them. You still have that talking as well, but there was something creatively interesting about trying to capture a scene, a moment, an emotion in a camera that you can't do quite the same way with words. And I discovered that you can really convey a situation with pictures that is immediate and emotional in terms of its impact. And that's why these pictures were ending up in high profile places in the way that stories weren't. And I thought, wow, this is really something I'd like to explore more. And when I got back, my contract was coming up after my year in Rwanda. I was looking around for other things. There weren't really any bigger, step up positions within Reuters or other news organizations that I could take as a journalist. And Reuters said, look, we haven't had a photographer in West Africa ever. We always just send them from Europe. But maybe we need one in our West Africa bureau based in Dakar. And I said, okay, yeah, great, let me go. And off I went, and I was attached to the bureau there for the next 8 years. And I did have a bit of luck. I mean, I got there, and when I first arrived, they gave me all these fancy digital cameras. I didn't really know how to use them properly. My first assignment, I didn't have a sat phone that was working. I think my laptop, I was a bit of a disaster at first. And I think the other photographers were like, oh my God, this guy's the Reuters photographer? What the hell's he doing? And I felt very much of a fraud to start out. But then I kind of settled into it a little bit, and not coming from a photography background or a newswire background, I kind of brought, I think, a slightly different sensibility and approach to the subjects that I was covering. I was quite into portraiture. My uncle had introduced me to a lot of the Malian photographers, so Seydou Keita, this guy here. We have a
book. Yeah.
So, and Malik Sidibe. The way that they photographed people looking to camera in a very kind of formal way, I ended up kind of imitating this on some level with a lot of the portraits that I did in color rather than black and white. It engaged me. I would look for things where you had interesting backgrounds and patterns.
So, in a way, you weren't constrained by any kind of preconceived idea about what the job should be. So, therefore, in a way, you were free to just do your own thing. And also, you're bringing a kind of writer's sensibility to photography, which I guess is another angle that you had, which maybe other people didn't have.
It was always about stories and trying to get pictures that meant something and that there was a feeling to them. And for me, it was very important as well to identify people by name, by age, where they're from, what they were doing. Even if we're in a refugee camp or an emergency feeding center or something, I wanted the people I photograph to be people, not just a refugee, a displaced person, a starving mother. I really did want anybody who looks at the pictures to be able to relate to that person as another human being, not just kind of a generic suffering person. So that's something that I started to do, and I became responsible for our network of local photographers across this region of, I think it was 23 or 26 countries. And I insisted that they do the same and make sure that all the spellings were correct. And it's a subtle shift, but a significant one, because when you're reporting from a place like this that's perceived in the Western media in a certain way, I think it's important to really try and show things in a much more human way. And the shift for me really was trying to tell these stories in a visual way now, as best as I could. And I was fortunate in that there was a group of managers within Reuters who were very interested in pushing the visual file into something much less newswire oriented, the old tight, bright, warm and shite box kind of thing, into a more magazine style of photography at that time. And as it happened, the timing was good for me to be coming up at that moment, because they clocked what I was doing and said, this is different from what we're seeing from other photographers, and it's from a region that we haven't seen a lot of work from. So they championed me, they gave me quite a few opportunities, and they encouraged me. And that was a really good thing for somebody who was just trying to figure it out at the time. And I had a stroke of luck, in a sense, when I covered this hunger crisis in Niger after I'd been in the job for about 3 or 4 months. And a picture that I took there of a mother and child in an emergency feeding center, where it's quite a close-up picture, a portrait of the mother's face with the child's hand resting on the mother's lips. You know, a few months later, it was selected as the World Press Photo of the Year, which I didn't really know what it was at the time, but it turns out it's like one of the biggest photography awards.
Kind of, yeah, the kind of, you know, premier kind of photojournalism awards, and you won the whole you won the actual whole thing, not just a category, which must have pissed off your colleagues who've been trying to, because you know, some people do the job for many years and never manage to win the World Press, and I don't know if it necessarily matters or means anything, but that was quite a thing for you to win it outright after such a short period of time doing photography. Did it change things for you?
Well, first of all, I didn't really know what it meant. I didn't have a sense of what World Press Photo was. I'd heard of it. I knew that we'd submitted the pictures. But when it was explained to me, the significance of it, and I was told that I should go to the award ceremony, I kind of looked at it and I was like, oh my God, there's no way I'm going to that. I just would feel very uncomfortable in front of all of these professionals, the top professionals of the industry who'd won all the categories and the various other awards and all these top editors. Because I, at that point, I was still very isolated out there. I had no interaction with the photo community. I was just kind of out there on my own. So I got there. Reuters convinced me to go. I went because they said it was a very warm and accepting environment. And it was. It was amazing. It was wonderful. And any animosity or anything that I've kind of feared there might be that didn't exist, or either that or it was well hidden. And it was quite inspiring to see all this other great work. And the truth is, you know, awards are a lottery, and it's, you know, it could have not even made it through. It's just, you know, it's a great thing to win for the company you work for and for your editors and for all that kind of promotional stuff. And certainly it gave me a boost and opportunities, but I was quite conscious that I had a lot to learn about the business. And I think on some level, having that motivated me even more to really try and earn it retroactively.
Right, right.
And I pushed myself quite hard afterwards to try and, because I knew I was really still just a neophyte to this line of work, and I looked at the work of others. It was so sophisticated, so good, and it gave me things to aspire to, not in terms of winning awards, but in terms of doing meaningful and quality work. And that's what I tried to do for the years that followed. And certain opportunities were presented to me that maybe wouldn't have been by my employer. But I tried to make use of those, and I tried to do things in a way that still felt true to how I had started. Because when I tried to do things in a way that others were doing them, it didn't really work. I soon discovered that I have to kind of just do things in a way that feels right to me when I'm approaching a scene or a story. And I think one of the things that worked in my favor is that I'm not a particularly technical photographer. I understand how the camera works now. I certainly, you know, better than I did back then. But, you know, I look at some photographs and they feel technically perfect. You look at it, everything is done just the way that it should be done here. But sometimes those pictures can still leave me a bit cold. And I think sometimes the imperfections in images are really what make them interesting. For me, photographing is really just about a feeling or an emotion, or trying to capture something in somebody's expression. And that's why I do kind of drift a lot towards portraits, even though it's kind of meant to be reportage. And it's really just about trying to capture a feeling for me. That's every picture that I think of mine that succeeds. It's about a feeling or an atmosphere or a moment that has something that you hope lasts beyond that fraction of a second.
Yeah. You know, which I guess as a wire guy, you know, you're up against that challenge all the time, because it's on the pages of your newspaper and, you know, it's going to get flicked past, you know, so the person then gets to the film section or whatever. And so, yeah, that is a big challenge. And it's almost like, you know, your sensibility seems to be more geared towards doing more kind of long-term projects. And do you think in terms of, I mean, as a wire guy, you're supposed to think in terms of single images almost, you know, you're thinking of the front page news picture rather than a whole, you know, a whole kind of story, a whole series of images.
Yeah, I was fortunate in, I've never been great at news photography. I have a great admiration for the photographers. I came to London and I went to New York a few times where I'd work for a month or 2 months on the desks there. I really struggled in those situations because I found it hard to do those kinds of pictures. And there are loads of photographers in these cities who can go to a really boring event and make a really good picture that'll be on the front page the next day. I struggle with that a lot. My strength and interest was much more, I was fortunate in this sense of, you know, working in West Africa and covering much of the continent, where I had a lot of freedom to pick and choose my stories and was very much self-assigning in consultation with my bosses at the time. But there was a sense that you've got this huge kind of canvas to work with, and you could identify stories. And once you've lived in a place for a long time, you really get to see it in a way that photographers who are coming in for short periods will maybe not perceive it in that same way. So yeah, I really did look at doing longer term stories. You know, the Congo story I revisited over many years and kept going back and building on work that I'd done there previously. And there are other photographers who have done much bigger bodies of work. One of my good friends, Marcus Bleasdale, has done phenomenal body of work there over a decade, really. And that's where we met. And I don't get to work on things quite that long, but I would, you know, I would try and work on stories for up to a week at a time. I did ahead of the World Cup in South Africa in 2010. I spent a month or so in the country, and I tried to work on stories there that gave you a real insight into society, but in a way that wasn't necessarily what the preconceived notion of South Africa might be. And that was what I tried to do all the time in my work. Yes, I had to cover the hunger crisis. Yes, I had to cover the military coups. Yes, I had to cover clashes and fighting and this kind of thing and disease or whatever. All the sort of negative or big headline grabbing stories that we often tend to see from the continent, I covered those. But I tried to flesh those out with more nuanced stories, where even in Congo, I did a whole series on women's hairstyles or on fashion in Senegal. And I still go back every year pretty much now to photograph fashion in Senegal, and or dance or music or these cultural sides or daily life. And, you know, you've got now Instagram feeds and websites and books by Everyday Africa that are really filling this gap in the way that the different countries in Africa are perceived and photographed by the local photographers and some foreign photographers as well. But that is hugely important to anybody who has lived and worked there for any length of time, is to show the full spectrum of life in these places. Because what we see in the media is just not fully representative of everything that goes on. It never is. Even if you look at the coverage, you know, of the UK, it's only a sliver, but it's the sliver that paints the place in a certain way. So I always did try to flesh things out as much as I could.
Because I was going to ask you whether you were sort of almost envious of people like Marcus in the sense that they had their own agenda, and you're, as a Reuters guy, you're more constrained by the news cycle, you know, the daily news cycle. Did you feel frustration? Or it seems to me like it wasn't quite how I'm imagining it is being a wire guy, that you do get the chance to do your own stuff within that, as it were.
It really depends on your situation and where you're based. So when I was in Africa, I had a lot of freedom to do stuff. A lot of times the freedom to do more featurey type stories was tied to going to cover a news event. So I would cover the news, but on the side, I would work on a longer term thing. The same thing when I was covering the conflict in Libya, I would cover the news, the daily clashes, running up to the front line with the rebels and doing all that. But then I would try to slow things down and I would do a feature on, you know, anti-Qaddafi graffiti that I'd seen on all the back streets in Benghazi. Or I did a series on the wreckage along the road, the Revolution Road, just sort of still life pictures of blown up tanks, of bits and pieces of things, just a different kind of slower version. And then when I was on embeds in Afghanistan, covering ostensibly, you know, combat operations and patrols and foot patrols through the various areas, I did another series on all the colorful kinds of doors that we would walk past, just because you need something that varies the pace of your coverage and offers something a little bit different from all the men with guns and the bang bang and the drama, and just show something maybe a little bit more thoughtful, a little bit more insightful as much as possible. And those always, I think, are the pictures and the stories that have, in a sense, a greater lasting value. I look at those pictures now and they stand the test of time better than any explosion, any kind of action picture, for the most part.
How do you feel that, you know, things have changed in photojournalism in that respect? Because it seems to me a lot more people are moving away from that traditional kind of image of what it is to do that kind of work, you know, to shoot the guys running around with guns and yada yada. Do you feel that that is something that's kind of happening?
Well, I think we still have both. I mean, if you look at the wires, the files from Mosul, we still have a lot of that kind of stuff. Mm. We still have the explosions. We still have, you know, certainly when I was covering the Gaza war in 2014, that was the thing that was kind of like the final straw for me, when I just said, I just don't want to do this anymore, because I was there covering the Israeli offensive into Gaza, and all the pictures kind of looked the same.
The same,
all the
yeah.
photographers, not just of that occasion, but every other previous Gaza, you know, offensive, big firebomb clouds rising over a smashed city, grieving relatives, and blown up bodies, or from the Israeli side, outgoing rockets and artillery, and I really sort of felt like I wasn't capturing images. I was just kind of maintaining an image of what this war looks like. And then you're seeking as a photographer to condemn this violence, but you ultimately, or I ultimately, started to feel like, in a way, I was complicit. I'm just perpetuating this image of what this conflict looks like. And so, to get back to your question about, are we seeing less of that? No, I think it's still there. I think it's news photographers and news programs that want that. If you look at, you know, the headline news from any of the big broadcasters, what do they show? They show explosions, they show missiles and rockets going off and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, at the top of the news. But I think maybe what we're seeing is a lot more of the thoughtful photography, that of things that go on around the periphery of all of this stuff. So you've got publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post that are doing very good photography that will show, yes, what's happening there, but also examining all these sort of human stories that are part of the bigger picture of war. And I think those are always going to have more weight, if even if less sort of immediate drama of firefights. But I think a lot of times what you find in covering these stories, yes, some of the combat stuff will be genuine, but you know, there are accounts now of, you know, when a bunch of journalists turn up with the Peshmerga in Iraq, they'll start firing off into the hills, just because it looks like they're firing, and it's just a picture, and they know it's going to be. And then photographers become complicit. They're taking pictures of these guys firing. It's like, oh, they're firing in the direction of ISIS. Yeah, yeah. Well, are they really? I mean, sometimes, yes, you know, there are pictures that are actual, genuinely of these operations, but other times stuff tends to get a bit stale. And it was the same in Libya. You had a lot of showmanship on the part of the rebels and the combatants. And of course, there's lots of genuine combat and fighting stuff going on. But I remember taking some pictures and I can't file that. It's not really, they're just firing at sand dunes, you know. So it looks dramatic, but
And also, if there's 10 guys getting the same shot, essentially, then it does make you start to wonder, what's the point of 9 of them being there, right? Because, you know, especially if there's one guy from, you know, if you're there, you know that your pictures are going all over the world within 5 minutes, kind of thing. I just think, I guess it takes a long time for these things to change, you know, but it does seem to be a lot more people questioning those conventions now.
It could be that. It could also be that you have fewer staff photographers who are actually staff photographers now. And so freelancers are going to cover these things, and maybe they have more of a say in how they're going to cover these things, and they will weigh their own risks and how they want to manage those.
Yeah.
Or they'll choose that, okay, so do I really want to file another picture of a guy shooting a gun at a sand dune, or, you know, out of a Humvee or whatever it is? And so they may have less direction or pressure put on them by editors than, you know, a staff photographer who feels like they have to deliver a certain image. It could be that. But I think also the nature of the kind of conflicts that are being covered have shifted as well. You can't just rock up into an ISIS stronghold and take pictures, like in a way you could in Libya or in during the Egyptian Revolution or Tunisia or any of these places. So the nature of the conflicts has changed. The kinds of photographers who are photographing them has also changed. And the security and threat level has shifted. So that all probably is having some impact on the kinds of images that we're seeing. And maybe editors are also thinking, like, we've seen that image before. We've seen that image so many times. We don't want to have that again.
I mean, this is kind of, there's a very apposite and recent example whereby a freelance guy who'd gone to Mosul and, you know, done a set of pictures and they appeared online eventually, but basically, you know, his kind of narrative was, no one wanted to buy my pictures, so here they are for free, on the pretext that, you know, it was about getting these people's stories out there. But first of all, they really weren't very good pictures, to be honest, not to kind of throw the guy under the bus, but they just weren't. And it seems to me that was the one thing he obviously didn't understand, you know. And if you are a picture editor and you've got like a gazillion pictures that look like that, you know, of course you didn't sell them, you know, why would they bother? So I guess there needs to be some education among young people who want to go and do that kind of work, you know, that you got to be aware of all those things.
Certainly with the explosion of social media and also the various players in these conflicts now also contributing their user-generated content, there's no lack of imagery. So what that means is a more imaginative approach from the photographers who are going to document it independently or for an organization. You need to bring your own eye and approach to these stories, because if you don't, it's going to look like everything else. And the value in anybody's work is not that they're there. You're not just documenting the fact that you were there. You know, it's not enough just to say, I have a picture of this. You need to put your personal imprint on the story and show it. And that's all the best photographers are able to do.
Yeah.
You can have six of the best photographers or great photographers photographing the same scene, each one is going to have a completely different angle, perspective, technique, aesthetic. So when I was in Congo and I met Marcus, we often ended up at the traveling together, photographing the same scenes, and we get back in the evening to wherever we were staying, and we download our pictures onto our laptops, and we'd skim through. I'd look at his, he'd look at mine, and like, were we even in the same place?
Right.
You know, he's processed his as black and white. He likes a very grim, gritty look. I've photographed in color. Color is how I view things, I think, and not just because I worked for a newswire, but that I'm drawn to colors. I'm drawn to, so my take on the same scenes, we're looking at the same subjects, but completely different. Mm. Well, and his isn't right, mine isn't wrong.
Yeah.
Or his isn't wrong and mine isn't right. It just, we brought something different to the story, and that can be done. And I think that's something for photographers to keep in mind.
I mean, the thing that immediately comes to mind when we're talking about this to me is, what do you know what I'm going to say?
The stuff in Haiti.
No, I was going to say Tim Hetherington doing The Sleeping Soldiers.
Yeah.
You know, that's a great example of what you're talking about there. Yeah. Because would anyone else necessarily have come up with that as an idea? You know, you've been in that very situation, you know, embedded with the troops in some godforsaken outpost, and you know, that was a very beautiful kind of way of taking a very, very different look at something that, you know, a lot of people had seen. So I think that does illustrate I think the point you're making. In fact, well, talking of Tim, I think, you know, you said at one point that when you were together in, were you in Egypt?
We were in Libya together.
In Libya. Yeah. And you both made the decision that actually the pictures you were getting simply weren't good enough to justify the risk that you were taking. So, you know, I guess that takes a certain amount of experience and maturity to have that kind of objective distance in a way to go, well, you know, to be able to judge your own work honestly, I suppose. And maybe that's something that some of these kind of young guys lack, you know, that they just think, well, I'm here and there's a lot of bang, and, you know, therefore I must be doing something worth doing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, as a photographer, I think any creative person, you always think your work isn't good enough. You know, we're always pretty critical and insecure about our work. But certainly on that, running up and down that front line from Benghazi to Ajdabia and beyond to Brega in Libya, Tim and I started out together, and then we split cars and we're kind of leapfrogging along the way. And we kept sort of saying, this is, you know, the risks we're running here, I can't believe that nobody's been hurt yet. And we got back one night to Benghazi and we're sitting in his hotel room drinking a bottle of whiskey that he'd smuggled in, and he just said, yeah, it's not working for me. I'm not getting, it just seems too contrived. Everyone's posing and the journalists are all gobbling it up, and it's not really. So yeah, and the story is well known now. He left and decided to not cover the story, and then on his way home had a, you know, reconsideration or a sort of flash of insight that's actually the story, the way that men at war portray themselves. And and he did go back, and he did, you know, we know the story now. He and Chris were killed.
Yeah.
In Misrata. And you know, that's it's a tricky thing to think about, but certainly, yeah, you do have to be able to make judgment calls on the risk to return ratio that you're making. And their deaths certainly sent a shockwave through our little community of photographers who do this kind of work over the long term. And it really made me rethink what I was doing, because I saw the impact that their deaths had on their friends and their family. And up until I think that point, I'd been starting to wonder as well myself, but that really drew the line for me. I started to realize that what I was doing started to feel a little bit selfish, because if something happened to me, well, then something happens to me, then I'm not affected if I'm dead, but all the people who care about me will be. And it really changed my thinking about the kind of work that I'd been doing and the risks that I'd been taking for myself and for my own kind of self-gratification and ego and career aspirations. And if we're honest about our motivations for what we do as young men going to war, a lot of it has to do that. Yes, we want to tell the story. Yes, we want to get good pictures, but a lot of it does have to do with our innate desire to prove ourselves to our peers or to ourselves even. And then, you know, as we get a little bit older and things happen, we start to feel a little bit less invincible, and you have a rethink. And that was a big reality check, I think, for a lot of people. Some confronted it by going back into those situations and by continuing that kind of work. And that was my initial reaction, was to now I have to go even harder. And
yeah, because you didn't quit immediately. You carried on for a couple of years.
I did. I took, not long after that, I took a sabbatical year. I did a fellowship in the US where I had a chance to study psychology and trauma and try and understand a little bit better on an intellectual level some of the things that I'd been feeling and encountering in my colleagues and in the subjects who I'd photographed. And then when I went back, back to Reuters after that year off, I thought, yeah, I'm gonna go a little bit easier. You know, I'll focus more on the social issues and on the bigger picture stuff. But then I got transferred to Israel, and I thought, okay, that's maybe not so bad. It's potentially, you know, slightly easier living conditions than living in West Africa and working in West Africa, which is quite hard work a lot of the time. But as it happened, you know, there was a big spiral of violence that was the worst in about a decade since the Second Intifada, and ended up covering the war in Gaza. And if I'd been thinking before that I didn't want to cover that kind of violence anymore, that really confirmed in my mind that I didn't want to.
Was that the worst situation you've seen in all your years of doing it? Or the most difficult to deal with, or whatever?
It was a combination of things. I think my threshold had dropped, so that I didn't have a great tolerance for this anymore. I felt exhausted emotionally and psychologically from having covered this kind of thing quite intensively for a number of years, and then had that year off to reflect on all of that and come to the realization that it didn't make a lot of sense for me to continue doing that. And also the intensity and the scale of the killing was on a level that I hadn't witnessed before. We're talking every day, like dozens of people, many of them civilians, being blown to bits in their homes as they slept.
And I presume kids as well, which I've got to imagine is the most difficult aspect of that job, is to see that, you know, to see kids getting killed and hurt.
I mean, killed is bad. But when the kids are dead, they're dead. But when you see kids being brought into a hospital screaming and wailing in pain, and the relatives of those dead children grieving outside, but then also the conduct of the media in these situations, and I was complicit in this. I was in there elbowing my way into the morgues and shoving through the crowds of people to make these photographs. And I found it shameful to be doing it. I felt ill doing it. It was undignified. But it was part of the ritual of death there. It had become the norm. And I felt very uncomfortable with this while I was doing it. It felt really ghoulish. It felt really sickening on a moral level to me. The killing, certainly, but also the way that we, as journalists and as the media, ran to these things on the pretense that we need to photograph it to show what's happening. And we do. But even the most powerful pictures from that conflict of the dead children on the beach by Tyler Hicks won the Pulitzer on the front page of the New York Times the next day. That it didn't change anything. And so maybe it is naive to think that, you know, a photo is going to change anything, and very few do. There are a handful of pictures through history that have had the kind of impact that turns the course of history or politics. But for me, it just became very hard to stay in an environment like that, doing that kind of work and feeling good about it.
But that hadn't really struck you before then, in all the years you've been doing it.
It had at different times in different places. So I think even as early as 2007. So we were talking 7 years prior to the Gaza war in 2014. I was sent to cover a plane crash in Cameroon, where 114 people had died in a Kenya Airways crash into a swamp. And there was a lot of urgency to get there to photograph the wreckage. And I just didn't understand why. Like, why do we need to see pictures of a plane? Like, how is that going to stop another plane crash? Yeah. How is that going to improve anybody's understanding of this? It felt kind of ghoulish to me. It's like, what is my purpose here exactly? To photograph these, you know, we get to the swamp. It had taken 3 days to find the plane. So all the bodies and stuff were kind of beginning to decompose in the swamp. And we had to march through the bog to get there for about an hour or half an hour. And there's jet fuel everywhere. There's bits of laptops and phones and diaries and personal identification documents. And I photograph all this stuff and I just think, and letters to people. And to what purpose does this actually serve?
Yeah.
How is it? And I just thought, I'm rushing into this place. I didn't want to. That was one of the assignments where, like, we need you there to go and do this. Okay, so I get there. And the whole time I'm just shaking my head. Like, well, I don't see what the point is of this.
Mm.
What does this possibly do? Who is this holding to account? Not the airline, not the industry, not anybody. It's just like I'm showing pictures of dead stuff. And
this is a kind of, if it bleeds, it leads kind of, you know, news mentality, which is kind of what I'm, I guess, talking about when I say that these things need to be questioned, and you know, maybe it's going to take decades for anything to really change, but these are conventions that we've come to accept. But they are just conventions, you know, the way that the news is structured, and what is it, and yeah, why do I need to see a picture of someone, you know, of a dead body or whatever? I've seen a million pictures of dead bodies. You've seen the actual dead bodies and been the guy doing
another artfully composed picture of death or suffering.
But
okay,
I guess, you know, there are people who do the job that you've done who do genuinely feel strongly about the value of it.
And I don't question the value of it on that level. I just began to realize that it wasn't for
you. So everyone has to make their own kind of
absolutely. And I think the importance of having people out there doing this, if that's what they want to do, I'm not going to question that. I think one of the interesting things for me, though, is this idea that that kind of work, war reporting, war photography, a lot of the justification for it originally and for many years was that if we're not there, nobody knows what's happening. Well, that's just not the case anymore.
Exactly.
We've got all the various parties providing, you know, this is content, it's not journalism, but we can't say that we don't know what's happening in Syria.
No, exactly.
The government is putting out their stuff. The different factions fighting are putting out their material on all the social media stuff. So we see what is happening. Now, filtering through that, you know, that's just the material. Filtering through it and figuring out what's what, that's the journalism part. But we can no longer say that if a photographer isn't there, we're not seeing what's happening. So that becomes, then the role shifts. So again, it returns to this idea that if a photographer is going to go in there, the reason to have them there is for them to give their take on it. What is their view? What does Paolo Pellegrin see in this? Or what does Marcus Bleasdale see in this? Beyond just being there, how to these different photographers with their own perspective, with their own sensibilities, with their own aesthetic, how are they going to show us this? And that's the interesting part. That's what makes doing this worthwhile. And like I said, I just decided that was no longer for me. I will be interested in focusing my attention on things that may be on the periphery of all these kinds of things, but I don't want to be going into the middle of combat again.
And to what extent was some of it just a kind of instinctive self-preservation? You know, the longer you're doing it, the more the odds, you know, shift against you.
There's certainly that. I suppose I felt like maybe I was still in one piece.
Yeah, exactly.
And so
why not remain
remain that way? But I think also you grow with time and with experience, and you know, like the reason I got tired with doing the celebrity stuff is I'd interviewed, you know, like I said, Lenny Kravitz 3 or 4 times. And again, it's like, oh, am I going to cover another military coup? Am I going to cover another contested African election? Am I going to cover another hunger crisis, another refugee thing? It just becomes repetitive. Mm. Those things still need to be covered, but I don't want to keep covering the same thing over and over for the next 20 years of my career as a photographer. Mm. You need to grow, you need to move, you need to evolve. And for me, actually evolving meant returning to writing and to focus on processing and making sense of all of those experiences through writing this book that I've written with a Marine who I met in Afghanistan. And it's how we both process our emotion, our experiences and the psychological effect that these places have had on us.
Yeah. So you've got this book, which is literally just come out or just about to come out. It's called Shooting Ghosts.
Shooting Ghosts. Yeah, it comes out on August 22nd.
Okay, so very soon. And we were saying you haven't got your copies yet, but they should be on their way to you.
They're somewhere over the Atlantic, I guess.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, your co-author then, TJ Brennan, just briefly tell me about how you met him.
We met at a small combat outpost in Helmand Province in Afghanistan in 2010 at the beginning of his 8-month deployment. And he wasn't too keen to find me at the outpost when he rocked up with his squad of 15 guys. But the next day I went out on a patrol with him. We came under fire. He was happy that I didn't freak out. And I spent another couple of weeks with them. And he ended up on another foot patrol we were on. We got ambushed by the Taliban, and an RPG exploded very close to him and knocked him out and gave him a brain injury. And he had to be medevaced to a field hospital. And I waited around the 10 days for him to get back, and we talked some more, and he completed his deployment as the head of that squad in that little tiny combat outpost. And I went back at the end of that 8 months, 7-month deployment, and spent another month with that same squad in that place, and just to see what their whole, you know, the span of their deployment from beginning to end, how it had evolved and how the guys were. And and then when he got back home, he started to struggle with post-traumatic stress and this brain injury that he'd managed to kind of keep a handle on, but had just, you know, now that he's back, it sort of changed his moods and his balance, and had difficulty readjusting and reconnecting with his wife and daughter. And he was discharged from the Marine Corps with, you know, for the medical reasons of post-traumatic stress and this brain injury. So he was at a loss and he didn't know what to do. And he kind of turned to me, and I started to help him write some stories about his experiences, which were published in the New York Times over the span of a year. Really good stories about his challenges getting mental health care and dealing with the stigma of seeking help in the military. And he decided he wanted to become a journalist, and he did a night school or online program for journalism. Then he got a job as a military reporter at his local newspaper, and he applied to Columbia, the top journalism school in the US, and he was admitted to their graduate program and their special investigations program. And he went on to do really well during the program, and he graduated in 2015, just as I was leaving Reuters, actually. And so it was a great kind of mutual relationship for us, because as I was starting to feel like my pictures weren't making a difference and feeling very kind of lost about that, I was able to help one individual in some tangible way. And that kind of gave me a restorative experience with him. And for him, it helped him kind of find a new way in the civilian world, because he'd had a suicide attempt. And I later learned that a lot of his problems stemmed not from him almost being killed with me in Afghanistan, but from his time in Iraq during the Battle of Fallujah in 2004, and things that had happened to him there, things that he'd done there that he was trying to live with.
Right.
Having accidentally killed civilians and various other things that had happened there. Some very heavy stuff.
And does he write about this?
He does write about that. It's all in the book. Mm. It's examined with very brutal honesty and put in a context that needs to be provided for those events. But he's also gone on to start his own news website that covers the military. And he, a couple of months ago, broke the biggest story and the biggest scandal to hit the U.S. military in a decade when he broke this Marines United nude photo sharing scandal that has changed military policy towards online sexual harassment. It's had Pentagon congressional inquiries. So he's gone on to be a very good journalist.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. That was a big story. And I don't know if hopefully the listeners will, if they don't know about what that was, then they can, I guess they can Google it, and we don't really need to get into it now. But yeah, it was a nice piece of journalism, and he took a big personal risk in a way, because I presume he wasn't, you know, I presume he sort of, maybe that some of his colleagues might have felt that was a betrayal or something.
Yeah, a lot of them did. Even though the guys who felt betrayed were the ones who were really betraying the code of
exactly.
Moral conduct and good conduct.
They're not exactly in a good position to take any kind of a...
Yeah, these are some pretty nasty guys, and they made death threats, and they threatened to come after his wife and child, and trying to get nude pictures of his wife and all this kind of nonsense. But yeah, they trolled him pretty hard. But no, he's doing very well, and you know, we're looking forward to launching the book this month and seeing where it goes.
How did the idea to do a book together come about? Was it yours or his, or you know, was it a long, it was sort of a long process of gestation or what?
Yeah, it was a long period of gestation, but basically I was sitting around telling the story as I'm telling it to you now about, you know, how we'd become friends and how I'd worked with him as he started writing. And this was an editor friend of mine at Reuters at the time, and she just said, you guys should do a book. I said, what do you mean, like a photo book? I said, no, you should write a book. And this was just before I was going on my sabbatical leave to study. So it kind of germinated and sat there with me for the span of that year. While I was in the US, and toward the end I said, yeah, let's put together a book proposal, and started working on it there, and spoke to an agent who helped us over, you know, the next 2 years, really, while I kind of was still working at Reuters, and while I was in Israel and covering Gaza, I was kind of putting together this book proposal. And so when I left Reuters in 2015, we along with our agent pitched the book proposal to publishers in New York. At the same time as my co-author, TJ, was graduating. So he graduated. We all went to his graduating party on the Wednesday. We got the book deal on the Thursday. And on the Friday, he turned 30.
Thank
so
God.
It was a good week for him.
And I've got to say, and also, you know, from your point of view, that so much of the, you know, your story is kind of punctuated with all these serendipitous moments and these kind of coincidences, you know, the whole... Everything, really, you know, your kind of introduction to Reuters, and then the way that you transitioned into photography. There's a great deal of, I suppose, luck. I suppose is the word, you know, one might use, but serendipity is the other word. You know, the timing seems to always work out.
I'm glad it seems that way.
Well, exactly. You know, because
it never,
you know,
feels like that.
No,
in reality.
I'm sure. But there have been a few moments where it struck me. How did you deal with the logistics of a co-author arrangement?
Originally, when we started out and when we pitched the book, I was the journalist writing about him in the third person. So I would write a chapter in first person as me, and then I would write a chapter in the third person about him. And he would send me stuff, and I would just help him craft it. He would write about himself in the third person. But our editor, once we sold the book, said, let's try two first person narratives. And so that's what we've done. We hand off chapter to chapter. I'll write a chapter, right. He'll write a chapter. And we would each write our own chapter, and we would send it to the other, and we would give each other feedback, and we'd massage stuff. So some chapters, there's overlay of the same scene, but from his perspective and from my perspective. So the scene where we first meet in Afghanistan, I'm sitting in this tiny little outpost in the middle of nowhere, up on a hill, sand and dust blowing through it, no cover, just on a camp cot. And his crew of 15 guys roll in from having done a 3-day combat operation with all their bags and weapons, and just chuck it all down. And he just kind of looks at me like, who the fuck are you? And I'm like, I'm Finbar. And he's like, are you a contractor? Because I'm dressed in civilian clothing, but you're kind of like in beige and stuff, and I had a beard. And so he thought I was like a military contractor or something like this. I didn't know him from Reuters. He's like, what's that? I'm like, well, I'm a journalist. And he's just like, oh, okay. And he really didn't want me around.
Very sort of wary or suspicious of you.
And so we get his, you get my perspective of me trying to ingratiate myself with his crew on my perspective. And then his meeting me is like, there's a fucking journalist here and I got to throw him off this cliff, or if he's going to come out with us and he's a liability, I'm just going to shoot him in the foot during a combat, during right, a thing, right. Say it was a stray Taliban bullet just to get rid of me. But gradually, you know, I win his confidence and we become friendly and it evolves that way. And so even on the patrol where he gets injured, I tell it from my perspective and he tells it from his perspective. So we're seeing it through two lenses. It's like in a film, moving the camera around and getting two takes on the same thing.
Sometimes. Right, right. Oh, interesting. Right. And part of it was, you know, as you said, you had this Nieman Fellowship where you chose to sort of look at the psychology of some of the, I suppose, to look at, you know, what underpinned the experiences that you'd had. And were you suffering from PTSD, or have you, or do you, or, you know, how do you feel about that in your own experience?
No, I've never been diagnosed with PTSD. The thing for me was that I would come back sometimes from these assignments and I'd have a sense of real kind of emotional numbness and dislocation from everyday life. And that kind of just progressed at different periods to the point where I didn't know it, but I was actually quite depressed. Mm. And I had to kind of, it was difficult to function in an everyday environment. And I found that I needed the urgency and stimulation of assignments to feel kind of normal again. So what you end up doing is pursuing in this sort of endless cycle of deploying to these kinds of places, because you feel, you know, at home, you feel comfortable there because there is this constant stimulation. But the daily stuff when you get home, you know, paying bills, filing expenses, getting your car repaired or the electricity turned back on or getting the internet to work, all of those things became kind of unbearable tasks that I would wake up in the morning and just couldn't even face the thought of getting out of bed.
Well, those things are tedious for all of us. So, you know, in comparison to what you're, you know, it's all relative to what you're used to. But I wanted to kind of pick you up on this, because this is one of those things that photojournalists talk about a lot, is this difficulty that you have in kind of assimilating back into normal life. So can you somehow try to articulate what it feels like, or maybe give an example, or, you know, to try and give us a sense of the difficulty that you can have with just kind of normal life?
Well, I think I first started to feel it in about 2008, 2009, when I'd been on a couple of pretty combat heavy deployments in Afghanistan. And I came back to my American girlfriend in Senegal, and I just felt really distant, and I just couldn't engage with her. I couldn't do the things that I would normally do that gave me enjoyment and pleasure, and like going out and socializing. Just didn't want to do it. I just wanted to like batten down the hatches and be at home and not expose myself to being outside and being around other people. And I just didn't want to do anything at all. I just wanted to be home. And I was very negative and very dismissive of everything and everybody. And that was kind of the first time that really happened on that level. But that's happened a number of times since, where I'll just kind of shut down and close down. And I just want to shut the outside world out. I want to kind of just switch off, go into my little cave, and not come out, not engage with anybody.
Sounds a little like depression to me.
It was, and I, at some point, you know, she encouraged me to ask for help. And this is one of the issues for guys in the military, but also in the media and journalists, and certainly photographers, is we're quite a, you know, macho, you know, we're tough, we're strong, we don't need help, you know, I can deal with this. Usually with, you know, a few drinks and getting hammered, or, you know, socially unacceptable behavior of any description, much of which I engaged with for some time as well. But that doesn't solve things. So in the end, she said, look, you know, you got to talk to somebody about this. It's not good. You know, I can't be around this. So I did ultimately, you know, contact the Reuters confidential helpline, because there is one. And they provided me with a psychiatrist that I could speak with, and that I met with, and that I did some sessions with. And then I did another series of 3 months here in London. with a therapist, and all of which was, I think, part of my education on the psychology of trauma and how we manage things, how we cope with things, what some of the best practices are for looking after yourself and making sure you don't slip into these depressions, or if you suffer from post-traumatic stress, you know, how you might be able to manage it. And a lot of what it comes down to is balance in your life. I was living in these places quite isolated and a lot of times away from friends and family. Sometimes I was in a relationship, but other times not. And you need a social support network that can bring you back down to earth and keep you engaged and feeling good about life and about yourself. And without that, it's very easy to come untethered. Mm. And one of the things that allowed me and TJ, my co-author on this book, to get through, you know, each of our struggles was that we did have each other on some level. This friendship allowed us to have somebody who, you know, he could speak with a civilian about this stuff. It's not easy for military guys to talk about this stuff with a civilian. The fact that I'd been there with him and that I was experiencing similar emotions, although different because I'm a witness to this stuff. He's an active combatant in these wars. He killed people. That was his job. So our experiences are totally different. But there's some level of connection there that he wouldn't have with most civilians. But the book tries to bridge this gap between the military and civilian divide. And so for a photojournalist, I had to kind of navigate what were the things that were going to be good for me, that were going to kind of re-nourish my soul, in a sense, to make me feel good about life and the things that I was doing, and so that I wouldn't sort of look around and even on a sunny day, it would look very gray and colorless and bleak to me. Mm. And getting away from a very negative and cynical cycle of thinking that covering these kinds of things had created within my mind, and just kind of reprogramming my brain to be in a healthier sort of state of mind.
Yeah, yeah. What was it like to get back into the writing? Were you rusty, or did you kind of rediscover a love of writing by doing the book?
I certainly did get back to a love of writing. While I was on my fellowship, I had taken a nonfiction writing course with a great instructor, and that had rekindled my interest in it. But it also provided me with some of the discipline and techniques that are helpful in putting together a long narrative that you require in a book, putting together the pieces, the characters, the supporting characters, and just trying to create a narrative flow that will maintain a pace and a rhythm for 330 pages, which is a lot longer than a 500-word Reuters report. It was great on the level, the creative level, but also on an emotional level, having the time to step back from it all and just engage with those experiences, confront them, and to deal with a view of yourself that is raw and honest, and be willing to be vulnerable on the page and to put out there things that are not necessarily flattering for my co-author or for me, things that we're not proud of and are sometimes ashamed of, and put all of it there for the reader to try and understand the full spectrum of experiences of what it's like to do the kind of work that each of us has done, him as a Marine and me as a journalist, and him as a journalist as well. And to try to come to terms with those things and feel a bit more at peace with them. And I think...
So catharsis.
I was going to say, I mean, for us, it's been a cathartic thing. I felt quite raw at the beginning and vulnerable at the beginning. I feel much more comfortable with things now and in control of that narrative by really spending two years reflecting on it, working through it, and massaging it into something palatable for the reader. Not just palatable, engaging and interesting for a reader. Then it's been actually a very powerful experience. And however the book gets received, of course you want these things to do well, but you have to feel good about the work that you've done creatively. And on that level, I do feel quite, you know, for once. You always want things to be better than they are. That's inevitable. But I think ultimately we've done what we set out to do, and that's quite a satisfying feeling. And you put it out there into the world, which is a slightly terrifying thing, because sitting at home in front of your computer on your own and bashing out your most intimate thoughts is one thing, but then releasing it to the world is, oh, now people are going to read
this. Well, you're sort of naked, aren't you, suddenly? Yeah,
you feel completely naked and inside out. So, but we're pleased with the result of what we've done, and we hope that it reaches some people in terms of helping them along what is often quite a difficult path back from war and from trauma.
I can imagine it would be very helpful to, you know, well, yeah, people who've experienced that on any level, with, you know, either as journalists like yourself or as a, you know, combatant like TJ. But what about the photography? So basically, you've kind of stepped away from the bang-bang, but you're not going to quit photography.
I thought I would for a while, and the weird thing is I didn't miss it at all. I didn't feel like, oh, gosh. I mean, and I would see stories and things in the news or, you know, what's happening, and I think I'd actually have no desire to go and cover that at all. But then,
but you could, you know, like your Uncle Michael, go and photograph, you know.
No, sure. And then I went back around this time last year, I went back to Senegal, and then I went back again this year, and I was photographing, you know, I've done it a couple of times now, but I've photographed Fashion Week. I love it. I was just being creative and visual again. Mm. It was so much fun.
So it's not the photography per se that you kind of became, disenchanted with, it was just the type of work that you've been doing.
It was, and I realized that there's a whole world out there that could be much more fun to photograph, and I realized I want to do stories that I enjoy, that don't stress me out, that don't some social issues will be upsetting, and I do still want to do photography that's meaningful to me and important on levels that I think matter. And I'm looking at a couple of options at the moment that I should know more about in a while. But you know, the other day, randomly, after not having really photographed much, I got a couple of assignments from magazines just out of the blue that were fun to do. I got, you know, a German magazine asked me to do something on Brexit in Northern Ireland along the border, and I went with their journalist and traveled around photographing people along the border and businesses. And then I got a call from an American magazine to photograph the MMA fighter Conor McGregor's old neighborhood in Dublin ahead of his bout with Floyd Mayweather next month. So, you know, I really enjoyed these stories, shooting them. And you know, it was different from the kind of stuff I'd done before. But yeah, I will be back in photography. But one of the things over the last 2 years, you know, I did a couple more fellowships and engaged with students at universities, and I've really enjoyed, as I did with TJ on writing the book and working with him as he got into journalism, is really working with younger journalists and you know, mentoring younger journalists and that kind of work, where you know I've been doing workshops and maintaining contact with a lot of young photographers or journalists and seeing how they can progress in this kind of new media landscape that we're all facing, and the innovations are going to come from them. But what I can offer is the experiences that I have and the connections that I have with the industry as it is now. And that's actually been really gratifying and really enjoyable to see these younger journalists coming up and doing new and interesting things. So I've enjoyed that a lot as well. So I can see myself continuing to do that, and also to continue to write as well. So I think it's going to end up being a mixture of writing, of photographing, and working with students as well.
Mm. Sounds perfect to me. Well, thanks so much. It's been great. Pleasure talking to you, Finbar. I appreciate you making the time to chat, and look forward to seeing the book when it comes.
Yeah, me too.
you too. But I mean, you've read it. I'm looking forward to reading it. And yeah, it's got a website. shootingghost.com is the website, isn't it?
That's right.
You're at finbar-o'reilly.com.
Yes, it's finbar-o'reilly.com.
finbar-o'reilly.com. Yeah. I'll put notes on the webpage so people can find you. People will know how to find you anyway. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks very much.